Hi, I'm Ted Zoller, and you're tuned into On the Heels of Innovation, a podcast powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. How is it that some people are successful in pushing their ideas further and faster than the rest of the world? What characteristics do they share? Which skills did they work to hone? And what lessons have they uncovered through each step forward and back that can inspire you to accelerate your own ideas for a business or venture? This podcast will explore the perspectives, insights, and journeys of innovators and entrepreneurs who combine creative thinking and perseverance to go beyond the expected. On the Heels of Innovation is powered by the Entrepreneurs Genome Project, which is a research initiative that I lead with my students in the Entrepreneurs Lab class at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, revealing the DNA that makes up successful entrepreneurs.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast On the Heels of Innovation, NextGen. And I'm your host, Akib Khan. On NextGen, I sit down with Carolina students and recent grads who are blazing their own path in entrepreneurship. When Rhonda Taylor Bullock enrolled in her doctoral program at the UNC School of Education in 2014, she planned to be an educator, not a social entrepreneur. Yet growing social unrest across the country drove her to become both. As co-founder of a social startup that provides anti-racism education to families, children, and educators, Bullock discusses how her research and pedagogy help shape her business decisions and why it's critical to inspire people to become more than just cognitive allies. She offers advice for social entrepreneurs on why it's important to build a diverse executive board, ways to make social ventures financially sustainable, and how to maintain personal and professional boundaries when the substance of your work intertwines tightly with who you are as a person. Bullock also offers words of inspiration for students of color just getting started on their entrepreneurial journey.
Dr. Bullock, can you please introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Rhonda Taylor Bullock, and I am the co-founder and lead curator of We Are. We Are stands for Working to Extend Anti-Racist Education. And at We Are, we provide anti-racism trainings for children, families, and educators with the ultimate goal of dismantling systemic racism in education and beyond.
Perfect. So you founded We Are while completing your doctorate in policy, leadership, and school improvement at UNC School of Education. Can you tell us the backstory of how We Are came to be?
Yeah, it was just a lot going on in the country at that time. So I entered my PhD program in the fall of 2014. At that point, George Zimmerman had been acquitted of murdering Trayvon Martin. Michael Brown, a police officer murdered Michael Brown. And it was just a lot of social unrest. And on top of that, I was experiencing my own racial issues, just being back on campus, dealing with professors and classmates, and just felt led to do anti-racism work on a much more systematic level. I think being a mom contributed to that as well, and being an educator and just want to have a different kind of impact in education and use an anti-racism lens.
Perfect. So can you just take us a quick way of like having this idea in your head, and how did you go about trying to find resources within UNC and trying to like take one step at a time to like build the venture out?
Yeah, so what happened was I had a former basketball player who was, I think, a senior at UNC at the time, Camille McGirt, and she had received a CUBE social entrepreneurship seed funding grant. And so I had met with her and I knew she had started Healthy Girls Save the World.
Save the World, yes, Camille, yes. I love her.
How can you not love Camille, right? And so she became like my mentor. So I was assistant basketball coach for her. And then she started mentoring me. And she was like, this is what I did. This is the path that I took. And so I was telling her about my idea of trying to start this organization. I was like, you've already did this. Tell me what you learned. And she was like, apply for this grant. And so I applied for the social entrepreneur seed funding. And so in the midst of applying for that, I had already drafted out what I thought We Are should be. And I had ran the idea by my husband at the time. And not my husband at the time. He's still my husband. We actually have an anniversary on Thursday. But I ran the idea by him and was like, hey, you want to help me do this? Because he's an educator too, also a UNC alum. And then I started trying to find people who could help like do this work. And I didn't actually know it was going to be a nonprofit organization, but talking with Camille, she kind of helped me solidify that. And so I got a team of people together, and then I applied for the grant through CUBE, and we got it. And so that was the first amount of committed funding that we had as an organization.
Congrats to you. And that's really good to hear how strong of an entrepreneurial ecosystem UNC has to like have these people you can like bounce ideas off of and get coaching from, and then get seed money to like start the venture. Can you just walk us through like what a typical day in the summer camps or the program looks like for our children? I know it's very focused on literacy heaviness in terms of like diverse set of perspective from books, but what's a day like from 9 a.m. to like 4 p.m. for kids?
Yeah, it's structured very much like a regular school day. And we wanted to do that so that kids feel some type of familiarity with the space, since we're approaching such a sensitive topic. And so in the morning, they come in, it's drop off. We have people helping them to get out of the cars. They go into the cafeteria, they have breakfast, so we provide breakfast for them. Once it's time to transition to the classrooms, we do a whole group kind of like call and response, icebreaker to get them loosened up. Then they'll transition to their classrooms. We have a small classroom, so we may have 60 children, but we'll only have about 15 to 20 kids in each of the rooms with multiple co-facilitators. We begin the day with a morning meeting. So we check in with the kids. We set the lesson up for the day and the objectives. Then we'll transition to some type of activity that will introduce whatever text it is that we're going to read from that day. We'll read, like whole group, read and show the picture book, whatever that we're reading from, asking kids questions while we're reading. Then we'll go to small breakout groups and have children do some type of activity to follow up on whatever the concept was that we were just teaching, some type of hands-on small group activity where they have their own facilitator. We take breaks. We have snack time. We may do some arts and centers. And we take we have lunch and then recess. And then we come back and do some other additional follow-up activity, whole group. And then we'll go back and maybe do another small group activity where it's like five or six kids in a group with one facilitator. And then we end the day with closing meeting and kind of recap the day, ask questions, pass out whatever book we taught from. We'll give a copy of it to the kids that day. And they have a daily sheet where each of the counselors have written down like a comment or something from the kids. We slide it in their folder. We slide their book in their folder. They put it in their book bag, and then we like exit out the day.
Perfect. Yeah. I mean, it's still like, I'm having a hard time getting over it, how cool it is to like have a venture that's so focused on kids and their feedback. Because, you know, like I grew up in rural North Carolina. I'm a brown kid. I'm Muslim. So like, just imagine the type of discrimination and prejudice one faces. And, you know, to like, I'm just wondering like how impactful it would have been if I had this kind of training growing up. You know, like sometimes people think when you get older, it gets better. It doesn't. That trauma stays with you. There's this saying, middle school trauma dies hard. I believe that so much. I mean, I've graduated college and I still go back to those traumas sometimes. Like, wow, that really happened to me. So to just think about like having those kids be prepared from such a small age is going to pay exponential benefits to them as they grow up.
Yeah. And it's not even, so on one hand, we're preparing kids to build themselves up and believe in themselves and to understand that this is a system. It's not you. Like there's a history here. It's nothing wrong with you and your skin color. And also because we have a significant population of white children, we're also preparing white children to recognize that racism is real, that there's, oppression related to skin color. And that oftentimes, you know, white folks have been the ones perpetuating this harm. And so now we're also arming them with that information so that hopefully we're somewhat disarming them at the same time and preparing them to be vocal bystanders when they see this type of harm happening. So we hope that is helping, you know, the kids of color who've been the victims of racism and also white children who more so align with folks who've been the perpetrators. And we believe that it makes a difference. Research shows that in as little as a week, explicit instruction about biases and racism can have a long-term impact for young kids. And so that that excites us about the work that we're doing.
Right, amazing. And starting it from such a young age just makes them better citizens of the world while they grow up.
Exactly.
So given the political situations, and it has been going on for the last decade, it seems like it, there's always this news cycle, right? There seems to be a pattern where there's a big uptick for the demand for diversity and inclusion training and demand for progress when a race-related event event occurs. And then after this, like, it's a trend that every single corporate gets on, and like, we promise to be better, diverse, and stuff like that. But when the new cycle moves on a couple of weeks later, it seems like the whole idea of like progress and equity just goes back in the back burner. Have you ever felt that way? Do you, or is it me?
No, it's definitely not you. I will say that for us as an organization, like, the demand for our work had taken an uptick probably last fall, going at the start of this year, because it's primarily been one person in our office. And I went to our board and said, hey, we need more people. So the demand for our work as an organization had already increased. But then after this summer, when Officer Chauvin murdered George Floyd, it was an explosion. I guess that's the word to use, but it was just like so many people reaching out to us, people giving us money and donating. Like, we raised money during that. First of all, we were receiving donations when we hadn't like solicited them. We had already planned to do a fundraiser anyway. And it felt weird receiving all these funds on the back of like Black bodies. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it was just a tough position to be in. But in addition to that, there was a lot of people asking for additional resources, asking for trainings and workshops. And so at this point, as you talked about in the news cycle, the requests have slowed down, you know.
Racism has not stopped.
Police brutality has not stopped. I mean, we just got the decision last week from the Attorney General in Kentucky, right? With Breonna Taylor, the three officers who were a part of murdering Breonna Taylor were not charged for her murder, right? They were charged for the bullets that missed and went into neighboring walls and apartments. And so the work, just because America's attention span has waned, it doesn't mean that racism has. And so we're still doing our work and trying to take breaks when we need to take breaks. And everybody else's sense of urgency doesn't necessarily have to be ours. And I say that to remind myself out loud, because I'm still trying to accommodate people when I probably shouldn't, because sometimes we don't have the capacity to meet the needs. We are actually hiring 2 additional employees based off our fundraising efforts. And so that will help divide some of the workout. But we saw an influx in request after, you know, this last racism pandemic that we were in.
Mm-hmm. And how has it been like, how do you take care of yourself, maintain self-care, avoid burnouts being a Black woman with Black children in the South?
You know, I'm still trying to manage that. But one of the things that I do is I run about 3 times a week, a couple of miles each time. That's very helpful for me, getting away, getting in my own headspace, listening to music, sweating, working out has been very helpful for me. And trying to spend time with my children and my husband, and connecting and talking to my grandma, which has been really nice. She's 82, so I love connecting with her. She's hilarious. But things that ground you and bring you back and hold you and comfort you and love on you has been very helpful during this time. But even with all those things, it still feels very heavy, because you're not just, this is the work that I do, but also, like you said, I'm a Black woman and I'm a Black mama, and I'm having to explain this to my kids. And then me just experiencing it in and of itself, like, it's still, even with these self-care practices in place, is still very heavy and hard. And I pray a lot as well, and try to stay grounded and centered and take deep breaths and meditate to try to put things in perspective.
What about in a team environment? So like, you lead the team at We Are. So how do you like communicate hard times, like the summer with George Floyd's killing? Like, how do you say, you know what, we got to stay focused, we got to get what needs to get done while knowing everything else that's going on?
Yeah. And so I will say, like, for us, we have a very active board, in that the board has served as colleagues for us, because we don't have the additional employees in our office yet. And so when these incidents happen, when we would have planning meetings, we would check in with each other. How are we? You know, how are you feeling? We have a board member on our team, Dr. Cherish Williams. She is a licensed psychologist. And so she will do grounding activities for us at the beginning of our meetings. And it's just been very helpful. And it's just something about, she knows how, this is her, that's her gift and her talent. She knows the words to say, the common things, the breathing, and it just really puts you at peace and at ease when we start our meetings, when she's there to lead us through those practices.
Perfect. Leading with compassion. That's really great to hear. So going back to UNC and your time at UNC, what resources and organization at UNC were integral to the venture? And I know you were part of the CUBE cohort and you got the We Are Resita grant from the Kenan Charitable Trust. So can you talk a bit about having the support from UNC as you grow the venture?
Yeah, no, it was very helpful because with CUBE, we were receiving mentorships. So in addition to funds, we were receiving mentorships and we were attending different workshops. And it was just very helpful because I was stepping into a space that was not my comfort zone. I did not go to school to learn how to run a social venture. I went to be an educator. And so the learning curve is sharp, right? And my time at CUBE was very helpful. So after I did CUBE, I kind of transitioned and applied to be in launch. And I learned a little bit more about some more business savvy type things and your target audience and setting rates and then getting a feel for getting out and talking to people who will be your customers to kind of help you improve your or inform your price point and how long people can sit and, you know, participate in different types of events. But just that was also very helpful in reading the book Disciplined Entrepreneurship, which was something that came out of that fellowship, was very helpful for me as the leader. And so it was just really nice having that supportive community. And then I'm still connected to CUBE, like we still, or campus-wide, I should say, I'm still connected campus-wide and go back and whenever possible to just kind of talk to folks who are there.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Disciplined Entrepreneurship is a fantastic book. I recommend it to everyone.
Me too.
Because sometimes people think entrepreneurship with the Hollywood movies is like overnight success. It's not. It takes a lot of long nights and a lot of crying sometimes to get where you need to go. What about your education-wise? So you did a doctorate, so it's very research-heavy and analytics and statistics. How has that translated to your work now?
Oh my gosh. It's helpful for one, reading and processing articles about the work that we do. So, and then even for me, I bring a critical white, so I'm a critical race scholar. So I love reading all of the articles and all of the things about critical race theory and education, the intersection of these two. And then I do critical whiteness studies specifically, and I study white children's racial identity construction. And so I use what I learned from my research to kind of help inform the curriculum in the summer camps. Now, I'm not writing the curriculum for the summer camps by myself. It's co-created by a team. But when we do the summer camps or even when we're doing work with the educators, I am bringing this critical whiteness lens that I strengthened through my through research, through the PhD program. And so that has definitely informed the work. The emphasis on policy. So the program was policy. My dissertation didn't necessarily completely align with what I did with the program, but that policy lens and being able to analyze policy and think about like impact and disproportionalities and looking at numbers has been very helpful to be able to analyze and then use the information that I read about and study and implement it into the programs and things that we're doing. So it's been very, very beneficial. And because I prioritize qualitative research. And so hearing the stories from people and now forming patterns across stories to give you a better informed picture of what's happening with racism in education and teacher prep and training and education and children and racial identity and education. So it's been really nice.
Amazing. It's great to hear that you were able to apply every bits within your venture as you work towards it. I like to say to people, like, whatever you learn in college or whatever experience you get, it's never wasted. It somehow will do full circle and come back to help you in some small areas. I used to do improv a lot. I like stand up back in undergrad, and it helps me with public speaking so much. So it's amazing, like, how full circle some stuff comes to be. For social innovation and social ventures, there's always the stigma that, oh, they're not going to scale. This is not going to become a multi-billion dollar company. So a lot of people just don't bother learning about social ventures. A lot of times social ventures, people like see that there's no business model, so they just don't support it. And I think that's completely wrong. Sometimes all the ventures and all the money is kept for like the next Uber app or the next app that will get you food in your dorms. I'm like, what is that? I don't need any more apps that gives me food on the dorm. I need ventures that support climate change, ventures that fix actual issues with racism, with food insecurity in like rural communities. We don't see any ventures there because, you know, they just like get small funding and then they run out of money and it's not sustainable. So sometimes we need to like reprogram to see like, hey, how can we have capital to invest in social ventures that are going to make meaningful change that are going to last longer than some food in your dorm room?
Right. Yeah. We decolonize, you know, this social entrepreneurial space. And I will say one of the things that helped We Are is that we charge for our events. And that is how we've actually been able to stay around, is because our events were not free. Now, we do slide and scale sometimes, or we offer scholarships in case someone can't afford the events. But if we were doing all of this for free, we probably wouldn't be around either. And I think that definitely, because a lot of people think nonprofit, you can't charge for things, but you can. And we've been able to do that, and it has been successful for us. And it has been very, it has helped us to sustain, while we also recognize that we needed to do some fundraising, crowdsourcing, so that we can bring in more folks. I will also add that we received the Kenan Charitable Trust grant, $125,000 over 2 years, which helped us to pilot a project in Durham Public Schools. And now we have, we learned a lot from that 2 year pilot. And now we have other school districts and schools leadership who want us to come and replicate this similar model. And so it's really nice how that has set us up to be able to do even more work.
Fantastic. So speaking of like having this partnership with other school systems, public school systems, private school systems within the area, how has the reaction been? Like, how do they react from the teachers and the instructors' perspective?
I will say for the most part, like, we always get asked about pushback. And so for the most part, people have been inviting us into spaces, and leadership has been inviting us into spaces, and teachers and parent organizations. But every once in a while, we'll get folks in those settings who aren't really ready, and we're kind of made to come. Sometimes those people are quiet, and then sometimes they verbalize, or sometimes it's people who wanted to be there, but they don't recognize how much racism is embedded in their thought processes, that they say things and don't even realize what they're saying. Even that, whether they realize it or not, it's still harmful. It could still be racist, right? And so the reception has been good. The feedback forms have been very positive. Like, we do feedback post surveys after all of our events, as we get a lot of feedback. Every once in a while, we get people who were uncomfortable, primarily white people, and want to express their discomfort or their agitation with something that happened in the training. But the reception has been pretty positive. Folks have leave our sessions, and many of them by and large do show up differently in their settings. And so we've conducted surveys using our connection with UNC, some undergrad classes, some graduate levels who will do studies for us and go back and interview people 6 months after they've gone through, you know, some of our training, and give us some feedback so that we can hear what have you done since you left here. So it's one thing to enjoy this event in this one day or this 3 day space, but if you're not showing up any differently 6 months down the road or 3 months down the road, you know, then you just had a decent time for 3 days and that's it. And that's not really what we were looking for. We don't want to do workshops and professional development just for doing them. We want to make a difference. And so now we have to figure out, how do we support folks after they leave so they can continue to make the difference that they came there to do.
Right. Amazing. And just going back and reiterating, your organization has supported a lot of grad students in their efforts to like learn more and do more research. So thank you for providing them with this opportunity. And you mentioned one thing about sometimes people come to the events when they're not ready. And I think that's kind of unique. Could you elaborate on that, what you meant?
Some people think, well, for one, some people come from a diversity and inclusion framework, which is fine. But diversity and inclusion is not the same as anti-racism. For example, we're going to talk about white supremacy. We're going to talk about structural racism. We're going to talk about laws and policies. We may talk about the violence of white supremacy and how it intersects with the educational system. That's what we're going to do in an anti-racism setting. And a lot of people have experienced diversity and inclusion, which is like, let's bring in people who are black and brown into this space. and why we need people who are Black and brown into our predominantly white toxic space. And without identifying our white toxic space as white and toxic. And so when you show up and we start talking about white supremacy and how these laws and policies created the wealth gap, and it's not the fault of Black and brown people being in a deficit lens, that messes with people's heads. And they're not ready to hear that. And some people are not ready to hear it. And so there's some pushback and there's some defensiveness, and we have to kind of talk people through that. And we tell people, you know, lean into that discomfort. This, for some people, this is their first time hearing that, and they had no idea. They were completely blind to it, or, you know, that knowledge was held from them. And then in some ways they were willfully ignorant, and then having that blinder removed in this public space with other people, it can be very jarring. And so some people think they're ready and they're not. And then some people show up knowing that they didn't want to be there. And so they'll show that in their body language. They might show that in their responses aloud. But yeah, that's kind of what we mean by some people were made to come. Like if it's a professional development for a school and everybody has to go, you can tell pretty quickly who did not want to be there.
Like what, like with the social media, and everyone wants to like have this branding of themselves, and they will post what needs to be posted. So it's like very unique and very, it's very special the way you said some people are not ready. And I do wonder, like, how do we get ready? You know, it's not always social media. It's not always just seeing a post on social media that makes you ready, or the next news cycle.
It's cognitive dissonance, right? So for example, you know, this is for somebody else is causing this harm, not me. And I think part of the problem is for white folks, they've been traditionally taught that to be racist is to be a horrible person. Racism is connected solely with like KKK and cross burnings, and you're a bad person. But there's a spectrum of racism, right? From like implicit violence to explicit violence. Microaggressions is on this spectrum of racism. Embodying racist beliefs and actions, it doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person, right? And so when white people are conditioned to believe to be racist is to be bad, I'm a good person, therefore I cannot be racist. Therefore my actions cannot be racist. And so they have a really hard time processing that, or understanding that you gentrifying a neighborhood and putting up a Black Lives Matter sign is counterintuitive. And these do not align.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes I do wonder, you know, like sometimes if all these efforts that are put into like social media and like putting stories and retweeting all everything, it'd be better to just like go to the local town hall and work on the policies. That will have more impact.
It's than performative.
Exactly.
I really like how you labeled it as like this public branding. Like I'm an activist. I'm publicly branding, publicly drawing this attention and further demonstrating that I'm a good person. I'm different. I'm not that racist person over there. And our friend who's a board member, her name's Shabri Day, she put us on to like this graphic that one of her friends created that said like when Black and brown people are suffering from racial violence, white people buy a book and join book clubs. And we had a participant in our Educator Institute this summer, her name is Sabrina Slade. And she said like, we need people to move beyond being cognitive allies. Like we need some more action. Like what you're talking about, voting, policy shifts, revisiting your hiring practices and policies, revisiting how funds are distributed and which vendors are we, you know, marketing with and giving the contracts to. Like that's the type of anti-racism work that we need.
Wow, fantastic. So one of the beautiful things about entrepreneurship and like working on a venture is like the journey. You learn so much while you work on this journey. Always with, like to say it's all about the journey, not the destination, because we don't know what the destination will be. So as a founder, you learn so much about yourself and the world through your venture, using the venture as like the vehicle to learn more about yourself, being more self-aware and learning about your community through the perspective. So as a former high school teacher, then going on to grad school at UNC and now working at We Are, what have you learned about yourself?
I've learned that I miss the structured day of a school day. Like this bell rings at this time, you have this amount of time to get through class, and then it's a break, another bell. And then it was something about that structured day, which I never thought I would miss that. But the nonprofit world, every day is different. Every day is different. The time frames are different. I've tried to put some boundaries in place to help me out a little bit, but every day is so different. I really miss that structure. I've learned that, so many things. I've learned that you really never stop being an educator, even though you're not in a traditional teacher role. I definitely see myself as an educator here. I'm learning how to be a businesswoman, whatever that means, whatever that implies, and learning what finances look like, creating budgets, being financially feasible. So having to learn a lot of self-teaching and then finding mentors who can help guide me to better understand that. I liked math in school, but I'm much more of an English person at this point anyway. And so just trying to do a lot of numbers work and channeling my, I did have a love of math, so channeling that energy to kind of get us through to make sure I understand what these, all the numbers mean and what the projections mean and where we need to be to make sure that we're still here in 5 years. And I've learned that there's nothing like community. There's nothing like community. There's nothing like working with folks and sharing a similar story. I've learned that I miss students. I miss teaching a lot. And part of it is because of the relationships that I would have with students and their families and teaching their brothers and their sisters. And that community matters. And that community matters in this work. A couple other things, just learning that as a woman of color, I need spaces that prioritize me being, that prioritize and affirm my identity. So in doing this work and being engrossed in whiteness, so to speak, I need this separate space where I can leave, see people who are like me, who've had these similar experiences, and love on each other and hold each other down, hold each other up, and just laugh and exist and be free. Like, I really, really, really need those affirming spaces. And so, and I'm able to build and connect and do that and create those spaces with folks who are doing this work.
Right. That's beautiful. You know, a lot of times entrepreneurs associate and attach their identity just to their work. And I think that's extremely dangerous because, you know, there's more to you than just your venture. You're a runner, you're a mom, you're a grandchildren to your very funny grandma. Those are things that I think is very important for entrepreneurs to understand. You know, like, I am more than my venture and I have other things that needs to be balanced, so I'm not always engrossed with what I do for my work. So that's really important to hear.
And I have to, sometimes I have to be like, is this Rhonda or is this we are? Like, where's the separation? I feel like we're merging some things and trying to keep those boundaries, create those boundaries and keep them. Yeah.
Is it hard to like maintain those boundaries?
It is, because a lot of people see me and they want to talk race, regardless of what, am I on the clock or not? There is no clock. When you're not in this nonprofit where I feel like the work hours is bleeding over, but if someone sending me a text message or a Facebook message or tweeting me in a private message at all of the time, all times during the week, after hours, and so it's like, okay, I have to like be off. But then because this race work is so integral to just your identity as a Black woman, like, because something happened and now after hours and it personally impacts you because you're a Black woman, because I'm the Black one, right? And so it has made it much harder to separate from the work, because the work in a lot of ways is a part of day-to-day life. You know, it's just, when I'm at home getting the update about, you know, another jogger who was harmed, or another Black woman who was harmed by police, it is directly connected to the work, and it's also connected to who I am as a mom. And so it in a lot of ways, it feels like, you know, the work doesn't stop. And I have to be intentional about saying, okay, for right now, we're just living in our humanity and we're not focusing on any of the things going on in the world. Like, we're just going to love and be present in this space.
Right. And when you say work, it's not just like checklist work. You just check it off. It's actually like being very introspective and like having these very hard conversations and then figuring out, all right, what are the benchmarks and metrics we want to build upon? It's not something that's already made up and you just like checklist. No, it's like actually being very self-aware and everything that else. It's really hard. I'll say that. Yeah.
It's very hard, and it requires skill and practice and then honing the craft of being able to, you know, host these sessions or whatnot. And it's taxing. It is emotionally taxing, particularly if you're carrying your own stories. Mm-hmm. So you just don't go in as this neutral person, like you're carrying your own stories of harm. And then when someone shows up and says something that's also problematic and harmful, you're receiving that as well. And so when I first started, I was like, oh, I used to teach 7-8 hours a day and then spend another 3 to 4 hours at school. I was like, I can do 2 to 3 trainings a day if I'm doing like a 2-hour training here and a 2-hour training there. And then I had like 2 different trainings in the same day. They were only 2 hours each. So I'm like, that's 4 hours. That's nothing. I did not account for the emotional toll that the work was going to take on me. And I was just feeling so heavy at the end of the day. And I was like, this is not sustainable. You can't do, this is not classroom management. This is not business and finance. Anti-racism work is different and it carries a heavier weight. And so you have to give yourself space to take those breaks. And I say that, and I don't always stick to it. But I am a work in progress and trying to put those boundaries up for myself.
We are all a work in progress. And, you know, like you mentioned something about the next 5 years. So what does the next 5 years look like for We Are?
You know, I'm still working on that. I tell folks that the vision for We Are came to me. Like, I feel like I was called to do this work. I feel like God was like, Rhonda, this is your space. I've opened these doors for you. You've had these experiences. I want you to go and walk. But I feel like We Are will be a racial equity institute in and of itself, where we're doing the things that we're doing now, but having a much heavier emphasis on policy, like doing some policy proposals and some policy briefs, and that we're going to become a much larger entity for training educators. So doing some policy briefs, maybe producing our own research, and then having a greater hand in growing and developing educators. I'm not quite sure what that looks like specifically, but I feel like that's going to be a part of that 5-year plan.
Fantastic. A part of me growing up in rural North Carolina really wants y'all to expand and be all throughout all 100 counties within North Carolina. So my last question to you is, do you have any advice for UNC students who are thinking about starting their own path in entrepreneurship, especially advice for people of color?
I would say specifically for people of color, I would say whatever it is that you want to do, don't allow other people's opinions about your success, your financial feasibility, your ability to scale. Do not allow that language to deter you. I encourage folks, if it is your passion, then you will find a way. Because when it's your passion, you work harder, you work longer, and you make a way out of no way. Find folks who are like-minded, who can invest in you, who can affirm the work that you're trying to do. And while doing that, still be open to receiving feedback and criticisms and help and be able to pivot. So don't stick too close to the idea that you can't pivot from it, because you might have a really, really, really great idea, but someone who has more experience or has been in that space longer might want to make a suggestion that could even enhance that work. So I just say, like, once you get that idea, keep working on it. Don't allow, like, we have to decolonize this process of becoming a social entrepreneur, and some of this language and the logic models and financial feasibility and scale can be overwhelming. But if it's something you truly believe in, find the folks who affirm you and who can support you to do that work and stick with it. And I think, you know, you'll be pleased with the results. And I will always say, be accountable to your community and don't sell your values short to get ahead. Like, stick to, know what you believe, know your values and stick to them, and don't, there are no shortcuts. I think people say that all the time. There are no shortcuts. But there are successful Black and Brown and people of color led orgs. And don't seek those organizations out to affirm you. And another thing I'll say is, don't be discouraged when the grants turn you down because you don't meet their specific structured. We've been told no so many times, like we've had so much success. Like we got to the point where we realized that crowdsourcing was actually our best fundraising tool and not applying for grants. As a lot of grants and funders who do not want to attach their name to anti-racism. And so we've applied for so many grants and have been told no multiple times. But crowdsourcing has really been what's helped us sustain.
Fantastic. Yeah, I say the same things about like competitions, right? Sometimes people go to like the startup competitions and they don't win. And I'm like, don't be discouraged. There's like this rubric and sometimes you don't fit within that rubrics. And that's okay. That's not a bad thing. You just have to find other avenues that works best for you.
Right.
So my next question is, what's the best way for the audience, the listeners, to stay connected to the works of We Are?
Yeah, so they can follow us on Facebook. It's /wear.nc.org. We're most active on Facebook. We have a website, www.wear-nc.org. And then we're also on Instagram and Twitter, @wear_org. And so those are the best ways to stay connected with us. We're always fundraising because we're a nonprofit. So we fundraise throughout the year. There's information on our website about how to give and to donate to help sustain these efforts. And yeah, that's, and you can also shoot us an email. You can email us at admin@wear-nc.org.
Perfect. And is there anything I didn't ask that you would like to talk about? Any question that I didn't cover today?
I would just say, because of the work that we do, and I'm, and we're in so many different spaces, it was very important for us to have a board that was diverse racially and ethnically, gender-wise. So I was very intentional about finding folks who were similar to me and different from me as well. But we prioritize making sure that people of color were a part of the board. And then we have a few white co-conspirators who are part and who have demonstrated their commitment to doing anti-racism work and being reflective, who were part of that space. And so I think I just want to say that it has been a team effort bringing We Are together. So while I'm the lead curator and I'm, you know, the one leading a lot of the work, is not me by myself. We have a team of folks who've given so much and continue to give so much to make We Are possible. And I'm just very thankful to them and to the supporters and to the community who's been asking us for more. And we just appreciate them for believing in us and trusting us to do this work and trusting us to do this work with children. And so that's been really, powerful. To see that people trust us with kids to do this work.
Fantastic. And going back to the idea of like having a diverse and inclusive team, that's so important because those ideas that a diverse team gives is so invaluable. There's this talk that without diversity, there's no excellence. And I believe that so much. So yeah, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the work you have been doing with your whole team at We Are. I know the impact it has made. And just for me, going back to when I was in elementary school, when I was in middle school, especially in rural North Carolina, I can see We Are having so much more impact and as it grows and as it does more. So yeah, thank you for all you do for the local community here in Durham and in the future for all of the nation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to share about our work.
Hi everyone, Akib here. So with this episode, we are officially done with season 3. We have created 12 beautiful, beautiful episodes this season. Season 3 has not been easy. The year 2020 has not been easy. Stories of innovators and entrepreneurs who are owning problems and creative innovative solutions has been the absolute mission of On the Hills of Innovation. We want to explore those stories. We want to highlight and celebrate the stories of the mission-driven ventures and the founders behind it. It has been an honor of a lifetime and it means so much to me to have you tune in and listen to the podcast. With that, I would like to thank Professor Ted Zoller, Kelly Browell, Brock Pierce, Sarah Daniels, and Sarah Sharp for everything you have done for season 3. And I would like to thank you, the listener, for tuning in and listening to the stories with an open mind and open ears. I hope you have a safe and relaxing break and can't wait to bring you more stories in season 4 starting in January 2021. I'm Akib Khan, and thank you so much for listening to On the Hills of Innovation.